Come in, come in. Come in, come in. Can you hear me? Oh, dearie me. I knew I shouldn't have left them like that. Why can't I remember? Oh, yes, it's coming back to me now. My missing adventure. In the Himalayas, the mountain, the monastery. Oh, the great intelligence. Oh, no, the Yeti, I must warn them. I've sent them to their doom.
Mike, are you sure we should have sent Alex up there alone?
Well, he insisted. All we wanted to know was what happened in the Abominable Snowman story. But you know what a stickler he is.
Wait, it's Alex. Are you okay, Alex? Have you seen anything?
Yes, it's some form of cave. I'm going in.
No, don't go in there, Alex.
Stay away from the cave. Oh dear, it's a Yeti. I think it's too late for the Who's on Target team. Look at the size of it.
It's huge. Look there, just what I've been looking for.
Are you okay, Alex? Is it the Yeti?
That horrific roar. What is it?
Oh, it's fine. It's just the toilet flushing.
Oh dear, a Yeti on a lavatory. Reminds me of that time in Tuttenbeck. Those chaps have quite a sense of humour and wit, don't they? Or perhaps you could say half the wit. Yes, that's it. Don't think I'll ask them to travel in the TARDIS. They lack the sophistication of Jamie. Oh no, that's not right. I mean, yes, sir, of Victoria.
I'm Terence Dix. Welcome to Who's on Target.
Welcome to Who's on Target, the podcast where we discuss the target range of classic Doctor Who books from the 1970s and 80s. If you missed Doctor Who on TV in those pre-DVD days, you missed it forever. Unless, of course, you bought the Target novelisation. So, jump aboard the TARDIS, set the time rotor for late 20th century Earth, and join us as, with a wheezing, groaning sound, we discuss, analyse and reminisce Who's on Target.
From Exeter.
This is Michael from Swansea.
And this is Greg from Swansea.
Welcome to episode 3 of Who's on Target podcast, where we're going to discuss The Abominable Snowman by Terence Dix. Mike and Greg, what did you think of it?
Really enjoyable. A big improvement on The Tenth Planet. Generally far more sort of likeable characters. Really exciting. Really good sort of representation of the Doctor and Jamie and Victoria, a TARDIS team that I've always loved. Yes, here's a little bit about the author Terence Dix. He was born in East Ham, London in 1935, worked in the advertising industry after leaving university, and then moved into television as a writer. He worked together with fellow Doctor Who writer Malcolm Hulk on scripts for the Avengers television series, as well as other series, and he became assistant and later the full script editor of Doctor Who from 1968 onwards. Seen to many as the godfather of Target novels because he wrote so many of them.
64, and I believe. I think I read in the Snowman, there's a little addendum at the end of it, of the novel, and it says that he went on to write 64 of them.
Fantastic. And can we just say a big thank you to Terence himself, because as you would have noticed on these podcasts, he records the very first word spoken on these podcasts. Me and Greg saw him at an event in Aberystwyth, South Wales, back in January 2015, and he very kindly recorded that for us, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Terence. We really
appreciate it. Thanks. It's brilliant.
Just get him back to it. Alex, could I ask you to say again, so it's Terence Dix. What did you think of the change in the style of this story?
I think it's got better pace than we're not going to compare because you can't always get comparisons. But I think it's got better pace than the last book, and it's got more fun. And there is a lot of action and violence in it, but it's well paced around the characters of the Doctor and Jamie and Victoria. They're sort of all interconnected to the sort of action and what the events of the main villain. So I think it really works a lot better than. Where the last two, it's sort of been sort of paced out between sort of villain and, you know, the main characters, and then you've got a villain. It doesn't all interconnect, where with this, it was all connected, and it felt like a better pace to it. It did feel more like actual, you know, an episode. You could see it in your head that it was more sort of filmatic, the way he writes.
Yes, the word I was looking for was paced, actually, in that garbled introduction I gave it. I couldn't think of the word paste, but you just did. Thank you.
And I wanted to say, as soon as Alex said paste then, and that's what it came to me when I first... because the last one we looked at, the 10th planet, it was a bit plodding. And like you pointed out, Alex, there as well, it was going between villain to goodie to... But it was a bit crude in that sense, I felt. Did you? Or...
Yeah, it's just not really sort of... I've lost another word there.
Yeah.
Alex will say it again for me in a minute.
Alex said filmic, which I think you can visualise this story. I think this is where Terence Dix really shows his strength, I think, because, like you pointed out, Alex, he interweaves all the characters, and there's just this fast pace. You can visualise it in your head, you know. And I'd like to say, actually, that it was one of my favourite stories when I read it originally, and when many, many years later I came to see the one surviving episode we have, we only have episode 2, don't we? When I saw that, it was exactly as I imagined it to be from the book. Atmospheric, really, the Yeti looked fantastic, the monastery was really lonely and frightening. I thought Terence did a fantastic job here.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. What you said, Greg, I mean, I spoke to Greg the other day and I was amazed that it was 6 episodes on TV because there's so much packed in, isn't there, in the novelisation?
Yeah.
And they don't leave a great deal out, you know, compared where they have a section in the anniversary edition, don't they, called Between the Lines?
Oh, yeah.
At the end, and they tell you the differences, you know, between the book, I think.
Yeah.
Something I want to speak about later is a characterisation, but apparently Terence Dix just gives... Professor Travers just a 1 or 2 line background, which is why he's driven to go on this mission to find the Yeti, because everyone back in London or if he works in a university is openly laughing at him. But Terence Dix sort of represents that in just 1 or 2 lines, and that's not really spoken of in the story. It's just sort of assumed
there
in the
is
TV
the sort
story.
Of bit that when he has the sort of dream at the beginning of the book, that's how they do it in the book, don't they?
That's exactly it, Alex. Because that opening, you know, people say that Terence Dix came to be a little bit, workmanlike, should we say, in his writing, you know, that it became not detailed enough. But if you look, I mean, what did you think of that opening, Alex? Bearing in mind that in the actual TV episode, it was less than a minute?
Something like that. Really? I mean, if it's episode 1, we've only got the reconstruction and we... The telly snaps, but I really
like it. It really sets the whole sort of scene of, you know, being in Tibet and why he's there, and it does it in about, I expect it's only probably in about a page or two in the book, but it's about a couple of minutes on the audiobook, and it just gives you everything.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I feel. I think you're right in there. You've got the character of the man, you've got his history, you know what his motivation is within, and I think that's a real mark of a really good writer. It's precise, it's quick, you know. I found the opening really interesting.
I mean, I look forward to hearing about Travers, mainly digressing slightly, but we always digress in these podcasts.
Yeah.
But we've actually seen Deborah Watling a few times at the Regenerations convention in Swansea.
Oh, yes.
And she mentions that, you know, her father, Jack, played Professor Travers, didn't he? In these two Yeti stories in the Troughton era.
This
Abominable Snowman and The Web of Fear.
Web of Fear.
She always mentions that the three gents on set used to play some terrible practical jokes on her, you know, and I see Professor Travers and I always think of that. If I see him on the screen or if I read him in the print, I start to laugh thinking, poor Deb, you know. But
Yes.
It must be just such a fun thing to film, but, you know, that's digressing from the novel, isn't it?
That's okay. I mean, I'd like to mention as well that I actually met one of the authors of the original TV series of this quite a few years ago. It was actually the first ever Doctor Who convention I went to. And It was Mervyn Haseman and Henry Lincoln. And it was Mervyn Haseman who was there. And he was actually astonished that it was so loved after all these years, especially when it had never been shown since. It was shown the once on TV, and all these people still love it.
Excellent, isn't it? It's just
I just think it's the story is so good.
And that actually shows you the power of the Target novelisations, doesn't it? Especially when so many episodes are missing.
Absolutely.
But as if we go back to what we were saying about it being very atmospheric, very filmic.
Yeah.
It is, isn't it? It's just that something about the wonder of man, isn't it? Seeing mountains.
Yeah.
And cliffs and hills. You know, it's
Andy. Oh, it's just brilliantly described, that whole mountain and the caves and all the bits around it are just lovely, and sort of, you just get a whole image of it in your head, really.
Yeah, I think so. It's like you say, for example, I recently watched The Abominable Snowman with Peter Cushing, the Hammer version. I don't know if either of you have seen that.
Not for a long time,
possibly. I have seen that.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, it's very, very I don't want to say very similar, but the atmosphere and the setting is very similar to it. And I think, considering that was a relatively big budget film, I suppose, I think they did a fantastic job, you know, in the one episode that we've seen.
I think, you know, black and white helps the Doctor Who era, because we notice more in colour, don't we? We notice, yeah. Supposedly, it didn't happen, actually happen that often, but the myth is the wobbly sets. The sometimes dodgy outfits on the monsters, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
Mirka! Nothing, nothing. But,
Well, I think the reason this works so well is it's the reason why most Doctor Who episodes work, where you just take a simple idea and give it a slight sci-fi twist, and it's brilliant.
That's really interesting, actually, because I wanted to ask what you both thought of... it's a bit of a concoction of things, isn't it?
Yes, it doesn't sort of follow... It jumps between scenes, doesn't it, really? It jumps between settings. You know, there's so many characters in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But somehow you still get the essence of the story, whereas... We'll go back to the 10th Planet again.
Yeah.
That was so sort of fragmented and broken up. And we've obviously said last month it missed the Doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, the Doctor is there. The Doctor is very important, but it's an ensemble piece, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Even in the novel as well, it's an ensemble. It's about teamwork. There
are lots of other important characters around, but the Doctor is still the major character. But they seem to work well with him. Everyone, you know, everyone works at the right level, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's as you said earlier, you know, the pacing is really good in this novelisation. You've got all the characters having a good crack of the whip, if you like, isn't it? They come in and they all... I mean, I think you said, Mike, that maybe they're not as deep as perhaps the character of Cutler was in 10th Planet. But I think, overall, there's a good feeling for most of the characters, do you think?
Yes, this is very much a feeling of what I'd call spiritual positivity, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a spiritual story.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
yeah.
I think you just like, get that general vibe of peace throughout the story, really, even though there's violence happening.
Yeah.
I think that's to do with the setting, though. I think that's because, you know, and also the sort of background, sort of Tibetan mysticness to it, and it sort of works well together.
And
that's definitely true, you know, but it's like positivity just breathes through the story, doesn't it? It's just, I think...
Yeah, I think so. And also, that I mean, those elements that we've got in the story, I mean, I don't know if you both agree with me, but is it based under siege?
Maybe.
If it's in a mountain.
Sort of, it does have that sort of siege feeling to it.
But yeah, you've got that juxtaposed then against the massive open space that you're on a mountain trail, isn't it? So
yeah, it's almost like a reversal of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like you said, oversea, because it's in such a desolate place.
I was just going to say that, you know, but the way they make it like a siege isn't a siege, because the monastery has its doors open for most of the time, so it's not sort of a closed environment.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It just feels that it's the isolation, that they are so far from anywhere. They've got these fierce monsters attacking them and destroying the monastery, and they've only got themselves to help them. They can't go anywhere. They can't bring in the reinforcements from anywhere. It does feel a bit like that.
And you have this sort of overarching control of the great intelligence, don't you?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, almost to me, the Yetis seem quite fluffy at first when they sort of... You know, they're able to stand still.
That's what I mean by having a great idea, having like sort of the myth of the Yeti, and then giving it the Doctor Who spin by thinking, no, they'll be robots.
Yes, I never found... You don't really find them scary in the book, do you, in the way you would a Cyberman or a Dalek?
It's... Well, I disagree, though, because I thought there was quite a good bit of menace to them, actually, in the book.
I don't know whether it's because it's, you know, the mysticism of it, you know, the mystery, but I found them menacing. Obviously, you're a braver man than us, Mike, you know, but I found them quite scary. I just think
the spirituality is wonderful, you know, and I almost want to, what do you call them, get a thing, a tambourine out and shake it.
Oh,
it's, that's a different religion again, isn't it? But I'm not religious, but, you know, it's...
I like the way how, you know, later in the book, you know, Victoria gets round her problems by sort of having that prayer in her head, and that gets her through not being taken over again. I do like that bit of it.
That's a nice touch. But I also thought it was quite the scene at the end where the Yeti smashes down the golden Buddha, and Terrence describes it as I think he said the head smashed from the body, and it kills the old Buddhist monk underneath it. It's quite horrific.
That is, it does turn to quite a horrific end,
isn't
it?
Not nice. I must admit, I did shiver a bit when listening to that.
Yeah.
I thought that was really good. When I said this sort of mad concoction of elements, it's like you said, you know, you mentioned the Yeti. They're not just Yeti, they're robot Yeti. And they're not just mysterious transcendental monks. They are alien invaded transcendental monks.
It's just brilliant. It's just brilliant idea of taking what everybody could believe and going, right, we'll flip it on its head and we'll make them robots and they'll be aliens. And, you know, it's something people can get on so many levels. You've got the religion, you've got the mysticism, and you've just got sci-fi. It's brilliant.
And that's what I think I absolutely love about it. You know, it's just... It's got everything. There's so much there. And I love the little touches that Terrence put in when he described when they were having the Tibetan tea, which I think he described as unsweetened and floating with yak butter. Is that
fantastic.
I love that. There was
soon to be available in Waitrose and other high-class supermarkets, probably.
Probably will. I think they do something.
Heston Blumenthal will be cooking it now,
Now you've both said that, I'm going to have to go and get some now to try.
I think what you said about the violent nature in the scene when the Buddha is smashed against the monk. There's one here, literally, this is the end of chapter one.
Right.
And, you know, Doctor and Jamie and Victoria have seen the mountains, and, you know, they're sort of taken in by the beauty of it.
Right.
And then you have this paragraph. Can I just read some of that? Is that okay, Al?
Go on.
You know, the Doctor saw a huddled shape a little further down. He scrambled towards it. The body lay face down in the snow. Gently, the Doctor turned it over. To his surprise, he saw that the man was a European. As he shifted the body, the head lolled over at a strange angle. The man was dead, his neck broken by a single savage blow. And I think it's just the way Dix can turn that from the scene of utter natural beauty to the horror that man or alien can inflict on man.
That's a good piece to choose, actually, mate, because it's showing that huge contrast, isn't it? There's the beauty and then the sudden horror.
And I wasn't thinking about that in my notes. Just when we started talking, that came into my mind.
Oh, yeah.
Luckily, it was the end of a chapter. It was quite easy to find.
I think, again, at the end of the book, there's all that devastation of artifacts. When they're killing off, you know, when Jamie and the monk are in the room killing off everything. And I just think, is it sort of meant to be a sort of smashing of artifacts and religion? I just don't know.
Yeah, that I was wondering that, because the significance of the Buddha being smashed like that, is it because the great intelligence wants the monks to leave, and they want them to get away from that place. What do they say when the wind destroys a nest, the bird builds another one?
But
and they want them to go away. But I am wondering, you know, is there some sort of element in there which, as you point out, Alex, you know, is there something like, is it saying there's a, not anti-religion, but I don't know.
I think he's brought in a few views, different viewpoints, isn't he?
Yeah.
Different ways of looking at it through different characters.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's almost as like their religion, their beliefs don't protect them.
Yes, that's an excellent point, yeah.
Do you feel that, Alex? Or?
Well, yeah, a bit, because they're hoping that will protect them, and then they're all being invaded by the Great Intelligence, and the whole of their sort of Aryan lifestyle has been taken over by it. So yeah. I think in a way, yes, but at the end, you know, at the end of the book, they go back to their religion where he, you know, when he's the only monk left, and he still bangs the gong for prayers, and knowing that they will come back. It's like, you know, religion is what keeps them going, I think.
That's a good point, actually. The natural order, if you like, is restored.
It is restored by, you know, finishing off the alien race, really, isn't it?
Could I ask you both, actually, why we're on the subject? All the elements, and there are a lot of them in this book, as we've mentioned. The Great Intelligence. Now, I Mike, do you want to go first? What do you think of the Great Intelligence?
I mean, we spoke about this. We're not really sure what they are, you know, what their purpose is. I believe, you know, they want to take over the planet slowly, don't we? I mean, Greg made the comparison to the year of the slow invasion in the Matt Smith era with the small boxes, wasn't it? In the Power of Three.
Yes.
But, you know, we've seen it return, the Great Intelligence, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yes, it just seems a very patient sort of alien menace, isn't it?
Well, if it's a man who can put up with making ginormous killer snowmen, you can see the patience there.
Yeah. Very... in any other sort of sphere of life, he'd be making Doctor Who monsters, wouldn't he? Or CGI.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's what I felt. I mean, at the end of the day, you're still there feeling, what on earth was what is the intention? I mean, we've got this incredible multicoloured gunge coming out of the triangle of spheres in the cave.
Yeah.
And it said as if it were pouring in from another universe. Is it pouring? But for what? What's the purpose?
I get the feeling that it would have worked better if it had taken over more than just one monk.
Yes, yeah.
I think so, that's very true.
Yeah, but I just feel, you know, that the Great it's very vague. It doesn't it doesn't come across as something, this is what their intention is, this is what they want to do. And I think that's, I don't want to say a weak element, but it's not resolved. Not really.
I mean, there's the issue of them being able to come back then, isn't it? Like the web of fear, one of these Yetis has been found and put in the museum in London, isn't it?
Oh, wait till we get to the web of fear, yes.
Oh, yes, we have to discuss the web of fear.
And it's brilliant. Back, most of it's back. Apart from the Brigadier's first appearance, unfortunately. Yes. Episode 3, it's back.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with the whole sort of, you know, having a monster that has a point to it. The Great Intelligence is a bit of a add-on extra, I sometimes think.
Yes. I think, I just feel that with a better threat, I think, you know, or not necessarily a better threat, but more of an idea of exactly what the Great Intelligence was going to do, we might have felt more, well, that pace might have been even better, we might have felt more threatened, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is slightly rushed. I think you both told me that Terrence Dix had a reputation for keeping the target novelizations to around about 125 pages, didn't he? So
definitely. The Terrence Dix ones are always quite short.
Short and to the point. So.
Do you think then, perhaps you first, Mike, do you think that maybe I know you said earlier, Alex, we shouldn't compare authors maybe, but do you think, Mike, that Terrence is a weaker author than the previous two we've looked at? Mike first, or do you want to go first, Alex?
Well, so far, you know, David Whittaker is out on his own so far.
Right.
Largely helped by the audio version by William Russell. Actually having played Ian Chesterton and using Whittaker's use of the first person narrative.
Yeah.
Brilliantly. Jerry Davis, really wasn't too impressed with that book.
Yeah.
I gave it a point at... I gave it 7 last time, but I should have come down to a 6 with you guys, I think. Mm. But, you know, I wasn't really amazed. He had some good concepts, Jerry Davis, some grand concepts, some huge concepts, but he didn't structure it well enough for me as a narrative. But, you know, I think Terrence Dix, if I was 12, 13 years old, younger, I would love this. This is where I'd want to start, The Abominable Snowman. But that's not to say he's like an immature writer. That's just to say the excitement factor is there.
Right.
He has the spirit. He has the spirit of the TV show.
Yeah.
He has got the spirit far more.
I think personally, but Terrence Dix, out of the three we've looked at so far, is the better writer.
Right.
I think it depends on what target book you get and what sort of alien he's given. Because you get something like when he's given sort of a later book, when he's given like the Autons, that Tale of the Autons book is absolutely choppy. It's brilliant.
Oh,
but I think because of having an alien, what doesn't really have a lot going for it. You know, the great intelligence, it's just there as sort of a gas as an intelligent. I just think what this is a, you know, I think he writes really well, but I just don't think there was enough there to fill up the book, basically, this time. That's the point I'm going with.
Yeah, that's interesting, because as you've said as well, Mike, six episodes, this story. There isn't six episodes of story there, is there?
This novel could certainly do with being fleshed out, whereas a tenth planet could do with being fleshed in, if that's the phrase.
Yeah.
Well, I think I can see how this went to six episodes, because there are some pretty good cliffhangers.
Yeah, I very much feel Jerry Davis was the weakest in the three novels we've looked at, because I'm surprised that he's a scientific person, you know, with his writing, but the ideas, he just didn't really have them, and the narrative pacing and that fell flat, I think, a lot of the time. Like, you know, Cutler was a great characterization, and he put a lot of effort into that, but he didn't get the essence of a Doctor Who story. That's the problem.
No, Cutler did encompass the whole book, as I mentioned. I became quite fascinated by him, but I think he did dominate the book, didn't he?
He dominated.
To an extent too much.
And I agree with you absolutely, Mike, with we've got David Whittaker, who's a superb writer, and I love the Daleks. That was some really great writing. But I think, as you... Which of you said... This Terence has really got the spirit, I think, or they said something.
The spirit of the actual. The story on television.
Yeah, I think he's
what
really
we know survives the soundtrack and the episode two.
He really captures it, and the pacing is great. And the thing is, when it's needed, like that opening scene, Alex, which you mentioned, you know, on the mountain, when it's needed, Terence can just put it straight out there, you know, within a few pages, we've got atmosphere and everything. So, yeah, I like that.
I'll tell you what I also thought was good is when they have, like, obviously in the book, so want to explain the relationship between the companions, he did that really well, and that must be about a page or two as well. Just explaining, you know, Victoria's history and Jamie's history. It's like, it had everything you needed to know, and probably about a paragraph easily.
Yeah, even though we know these characters from what we've seen that survives other episodes, and we've met both Fraser Hines and, I've forgotten her name, Deborah Watling.
Deborah Watling,
we still want to know more about them, don't you? And he's very, very quick at
absolutely, yes, yeah,
describing the character to you, giving them that background, just a simple few lines, and you know Victoria's come from.
Yeah,
doesn't she come from the Victorian era?
Yes, her
father's been killed by the Daleks.
From Victoria, and she gets involved the Doctor with that brilliant. The number one was gone missing. The power of the Daleks.
Mm.
Ah, right. Yes.
Such a shame. They need to start appearing somewhere, don't they? No.
And do you know, I don't know if who else has photographs of any of the characters, but perhaps we could, if we've got any photos or things of interest, we could put them up on our Facebook page.
Definitely, if anyone wants to, send any interest, we didn't mention it in the last two podcasts, so we have a Facebook page, just search for Who's on Target podcast. And we have a Twitter account now, which is at Who's on Target, no spaces.
And we also have a blog, which we can put up, and that's at whosontarget@wordpress.com.
Oh, excellent, excellent. So, which needs a little bit of filling up at the moment, to be honest, but
That's why, please send things in to us. We really would love to hear things. And if you send in audio feedback, if you send us a little MP3 recording, we could, Mike, our chief editor here, could pop it into, you could do that, Mike, can you?
Definitely, mate, yeah, definitely.
Memorable moments, then.
There's that moment, that's why I've been flicking through the book for the last half hour, trying to find it, is the one where Dix writes it superbly, like, Jamie, is it the first time they spot a Yeti on the path? Or when they first realise the Yeti is a menace?
And when he's still.
Yeah, the Yeti is still, and sort of Dix builds it up, and I think the Doctor says something along the lines of, "Oh, don't do anything rash now, Jamie." You know, and it's built up as, you know, the Doctor's this sensible man who just will go and obviously talk to the intelligence. He will go and explain things to it. And then Dix writes, "The Doctor hurled a rock at the Yeti." And that had been Stitches.
You told me about that before I saw it, Mike, and when I came to that part as well, I loved it. It really captured Patrick Troughton's Doctor, didn't it?
Oh, definitely. And even later on, someone like Tom's, who could go from, you know, deathly serious to giggles in schoolboy sort of antics in in a whisker, can't they? The best ones can, I think. The best incarnation.
Oh, totally. I think Peter can do that. I think Capaldi can do that as well.
Yeah, definitely, that'd be interesting. Yeah, I'm so looking forward to seeing some more Capaldi this year. It's going to be wonderful. But that going back to that bit there with the stone, yeah, the doc. I think Terence Dix writes as does he not say I threw a rock on the. Oh, no, but he bonked him on the nose with it, I think he said, yeah. He bonked him on the nose. And
it's
I
a
thought,
word you don't hear anymore.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
Apart from a different context, yeah, but we won't go there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just for the family.
But it was so comical, but I also thought, isn't it typical of the Doctor being so sort of reverential of life and animals, and then he decides to hurl a rock at the most sensitive part, you know, right on the nose of it.
Well, we obviously know he's more intelligent than the rest of us, and he knows it's not a real Yeti, doesn't he? I mean, that's the get-out clause, really.
He sussed it out from the beginning, I think.
He's not going to be going.
Yes.
He's killing a mythical creature just for laughs, I think. But,
Alex, what about you? Any stand-up moments?
I thought a really good... Well, I got two. I think the first one is where he's being, you know, Victoria's sort of being put in the trance and the Doctor's editing her memory. And I just thought that was really well written and clever, the way, you know, it comes over. And, you know, sort of how he does actually care for the sort of companions he's with, and that, you know, he's a bit fragile and that. Yeah, I thought it was really well done.
I hope I haven't stolen this from you, but it's actually a real air of poignancy at the end when Padma Sambhavat actually dies. Doctor next to him. You know, his final words I thought were beautiful. You know, at last I shall have peace. I waited so long, Doctor. I knew you would come and save me from myself. You know, the old man's head fell back. The Doctor says goodbye, old friend, then. You know,
it's just beautifully done.
So simple. The wording is so simple, but it's so poignant. And it's like a representation of what we said before about these aliens, like a slow invasion. They take their time over everything.
Yeah,
that's like the whole nature, isn't it, of the Buddhist faith? I think it's just taking your time,
right?
Living in the moment, isn't it? But also taking your time over life. And this Padma Sambhavar has obviously waited a long time for the Doctor and old friend to release him from this pain of being controlled by the alien menace.
Yeah. That's a lovely line, Mike, isn't it? That's a lovely... I think that's great. What do you think, Alex?
I really like... that was one of my favourites as well. But I also like the sort of... the bit before that, where there's the mind games between the Doctor and the main monk, while they're smashing the room up, and that sort of concentration level, the sort of build-up, it was brilliantly written.
And the scene at the end of the book, where the Yeti attack the monastery, is one of sheer sort of battle-scale devastation, and yet when it's all over and everybody is sort of trying to get themselves together and recover from the attack, it's really... quite sad and haunting, and there's a real feeling that, you know, something terrible has happened.
I do love the idea of the mountains glowing, slowly coming down the mountainside. I just thought that was an excellent concept, you know?
Yes.
How sort of frightening it would be.
Yes. One thing which I did when I was reading, I mean, this is probably, it's typical, isn't it, you know, Alex and Mike talk about some beautiful scenes regarding spirituality and fantastic description and pace. And the one which made me a laugh was when the Doctor was being put out as bait for the Yeti early in the story. And Terence uses these words: the Doctor was being firmly lashed with leather thongs. Now, Isaac, is it me only? But,
well, we were all thinking it, so we were all thinking it. But
I thought Terence must have had a smile on his face when he was writing that. And especially when they untie him and it says, the Doctor, they say to the Doctor, are you all right? And he says, yes, just a little stiff. There's got to, I don't know.
Terrible, Terence, how dare you?
Maybe you let it that out, Mike. I
think that's after what I just let in.
It's the whole Patrick Troughton joke thing there again. I can just see him getting away with that.
Oh, do you know, actually? Oh, no, yes.
I don't remember if he says that. Does he in the soundtrack? I can't remember.
What's that, Mike?
Does he use the phrase, I was a little stiff, in the soundtrack? Or
I don't know. But those are the words in the book. But as Alex just pointed out, yeah, they do have that, because Jamie and the Doctor, they always have that routine, don't they, where Jamie says, look at the size on that thing.
Oh, yeah, Fraser mentions that, doesn't he? Yeah,
and then Patrick Troughton says, it's big, isn't it, or something.
I'd be worried if we did see the thongs on any recovered episodes that appear now.
Well, I like that. You're really anxious to mention the drawings in there.
In the novelisation. Brilliant. Yeah.
But just before we move on to that, as it's the first Terence Dicks novel we've read, can I say as well, it's our first meeting with those two famous phrases coined by Dicks, which are, with a wheezing, groaning sound for the TARDIS, and also he says, a mysterious traveller in space and time known only as...
The Doctor. Hooray!
So, they sent a shiver down my spine whenever I see those.
Illustrate your theme running through them. You know, they have fabulous drawings.
Fabulous, yeah.
You know, made by
brilliant.
Made by a gentleman called Chris Achilleos, I believe. So, it'd be interesting to see a few more of those as we move along.
Sorry, Mike, I read the thing earlier. I believe, sorry to, I don't want to correct you there, but Chris Achilleos did the covers.
Oh, the covers,
but
sorry.
If you look at the internal drawings are done by somebody in the special edition, which Mike has got, of The Abominable Snowman. There's an addendum in the back which tells us the name of the artist who does the interior drawings.
Oh, the interior ones. I must have misread.
Oh, I love that book. Yeah. That book had great artwork.
Oh, dude, I can't wait.
Alan Willow. Thank you, Mr. Alan Willow. Sorry for getting you wrong there. And thank you to Chris Achilleos for those wonderful covers.
Thank you, mate. Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
This is going to be quite a high eight, around about eight bordering on the nine, I think, for me. I really like the pace of it. Yeah. The spirit, as we've said. There's a certain amount of good characterisation, but it's short and swift.
Yeah.
As we've mentioned already, it could do with being fleshed out. But yes, for me, a solid 8 out of 10.
Fantastic. Alex?
Well, I'd probably stretch it to a 9 because I think it's a really good book. It's well written. It's got great pace. There's lots of action. My only little nitpick is the actual sort of workings out of the main alien, because I just don't think the intelligence is a great alien. I just think it's a bit lackluster. Needs a bit more detail. A bit more saying. You know, why was he there? What was the point of him? So. I'd say a 9. I think it's a brilliant book.
Yeah, that's excellent. And for myself, I really want to give it a 9. I really do, because I love it so much. But because I know some of the other ones that are going to be coming up, and like you mentioned, the demons and so forth, I'm like, go on.
That's a good point.
I'll split it down the middle. 8.5.
It's a massive Christopher Eccleston out of 10 from Alex then. 8.5 from Greg, so that's John Hurt. It's a Paul McGann from me. It's an 8, so what have we got? Oh, addition now. 8.5 is 16.5 plus 25.5. 25.5 out of 30.
Very good.
Well done. A great introduction to Terence Dick's work on these wonderful novels.
Well, we should also discuss that, you know, most of us have probably listened to this as the audiobook, which is out there by BBC Audiobooks, written by, as we said, Terence Dicks, but read by David Troughton, which, of course, is Pat Troughton's son. It's brilliantly done. It's got some great sound effects and great noises and yetis and that, and he does a pretty good performance of his dad. What do you two think?
I certainly think he captures the spirit of his father superbly. He's just there, basically, isn't it? You know, there's moments, there's the odd phrase, the odd word, you think, oh, Pat's back, Pat's in the room.
Absolutely. I loved it. I think it's a fantastically done audiobook. As you said, the special effects are superb. I love the howling wind and the in the back. And the roars of the Yeti are great. Mm. Really, really good. But, yeah, David Troughton's performance is... excellent. He sends shivers down my spine when you say you get those moments when you'd swear it's his father.
Yeah.
Especially when he says his father's words and he's just got the intonation right.
Yeah, the inflection's there, isn't it?
Before we go on this podcast, I would like to thank Mr. Christopher Thompson for his excellent portrayal of Patrick Troughton for the sketch at the beginning of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Also to add that if you would like to contact us, we have a Twitter account. You need to type in @WhosOnTarget, all one word, no spaces. We have a Facebook page, search for Who's On Target. We have a WhosOnTarget@gmail.com email address, and there is a WordPress page for us. Thank you. Next time, Who's On Target reviews Doctor Who and the Carnival of Monsters.
by Terence Dix. On Target, Episode 3, featured Greg James, Michael Winks, and Alex Gibbons, who appeared via video call. The Second Doctor was performed by Christopher Thompson. Doctor Who theme tune was composed by Delia Derbyshire and Ron Grainer. Arrangement by YouTube user Bendy Keys Music. Who's on Target Podcast 3 was recorded in Swansea, South Wales, during April 2015.